This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Jose Reza came to Immokalee, Florida, a community full of immigrants without papers, when he was 15. His mother, Guillermina, brought him out of Mexico because there were bodies of young men hanging in the street in the town where they lived. She was afraid for her son's life. Both Jose and Guillermina are undocumented. Jose came to our attention because he's a runner who found in his sport a series of opportunities, and if this story is beginning to sound familiar, it's because I told a little bit of it a year ago on this program. Jose's prospects started improving just as he was finishing high school in 2016.
That day of my graduation that I told her, "Hey, Mom, it's not over. I'm going to college. It's possible now. It's not just a dream."
Jose's determination to make his dreams reality encouraged us to update his story. It's no surprise that Jose had wanted to go to college. He's academically qualified. He was a straight-A student in high school, and he thinks he'd like to become a biology teacher. But because he is undocumented, he has no access to federal college loans, and because he has no Social Security card, his work options are limited. But late in his high school career, Jose found running, and he felt free when he ran, and he discovered he was good at it. Running helped remind him of what he could do in a world full of things he couldn't do.
It teaches me the disciplines. I find an obstacle, I overcome it, and then find another one and another one, and then I overcome it. That's something I'm passionate about. Now, if I could do it for the rest of my life, I would definitely do it.
In the short run, track provided Jose with the opportunity to attend Allen Community College in Iola, Kansas, on an athletic scholarship. He began classes at Allen in 2016. Here's his English professor, Tracy Lee.
My first impression was, you know, what a sweet and great kid. He was just so excited and had such a, you know, happy persona and was just so delighted to be at college.
Delighted Jose was, but still anxious. He'd never before been apart from his mother, who'd now be on her own back in Florida. His scholarship covered tuition, room and board, and books, but for anything else, he was dependent on a GoFundMe page and various other manifestations of the kindness of strangers and people who would not be strangers for long. Again, Professor Lee.
You know, myself and a couple of others have made sure that he's financially able to exist, you know, day-to-day expenses and things like that. He has also been attending a local church, and I know that the parishioners have been very supportive and have also taken him into their homes, fed him, what small communities typically do.
Small communities, and especially generous and thoughtful English teachers.
She actually went to Walmart and bought me socks, bought me like sweatpants, bought me like sweatshirts, and bought me a blanket to have in my dorm, making sure that I have everything that I need.
Outside the college gates, Jose's welcome was cooler.
We had shared a little bit of his story on our college Facebook, and there were quite a few derogatory comments. They even had one individual who said that they were going to see that he was deported.
As Election Day 2016 approached, Jose worried about the prevalence and power of that sentiment. As a candidate, Donald Trump had left no doubt about where he stood on immigrants without documentation and what he intended to do about them. Jose Reza attracted the attention of documentary film producer Joanna Suarez. She and her crew followed Jose from Immokalee to Iola. On election night, they joined him, his girlfriend Maria, and several of their classmates.
We were like all nervous, and we were like almost like counseling each other, you know, it's not going to happen, you know, it's just not possible. But then the results started coming in, and then when they announced that the Trump had won the state of Florida, that's when we knew everything was over.
Damas y caballeros, Donald Trump es el presidente de los Estados Unidos.
My friends and I decided to just turn off the TV. The next morning, everything was just quiet. My friends didn't really want to talk about it. You know, some of my teachers even canceled class because they were disappointed.
At this point, Jose's anxiety about his future began distracting him from his sport.
I would go to sleep wondering, what's it going to be of me tomorrow? Am I still going to be here? Am I going to get a call telling me that my mom was deported? I wasn't eating the way I was supposed to. I started getting injured. Like, I got an ankle injury, and then I got a knee injury, and then I got a hip injury, and then my Achilles. It was just the fact that I was just too exhausted.
Perhaps it was in part the exhaustion that led Jose to return to his mother's home for winter break earlier than he'd planned.
She thought I was going to get home about 2 weeks later than I did. She didn't expect me that day.
Joanna Suarez, filming Jose for her documentary, was there.
And I just kept rolling and just seeing the look on her face, I mean, that was incredible.
After that visit, shorter than Guillermina would have liked, Jose returned to Kansas while he was rehabbing at Allen, encouraged because his track coach told him that his scholarship was safe, that he should concentrate on his classwork and getting healthy. His mother was struggling.
She was even scared to go to the mailbox out of fear that either ICE would be there or county police.
She was afraid of having the TV loud, of having the lights on, of making noises in the house, because if immigration was to show up at the house, they were going to know she was there.
In February, Guillermina called her son.
I thought it was strange because she called me in the middle of the night. She called me crying, and she said, I just had enough. I'm sorry. You know me as a strong woman, but I just can't take it no more. She told me that she had decided to go back to Mexico. She thought that the best thing for me was to go back with her. She didn't want to leave me alone in this country.
Initially, Jose was inclined to agree with his mother. They'd always taken care of each other. He couldn't imagine letting her go back to Mexico on her own any more than she could imagine leaving him alone in Kansas. But by then, Jose wasn't alone. Tracy Lee assured him of that.
He could do more good for her by staying and getting an education, and it might mean, you know, being separated for a while longer, but perhaps his status might change, and eventually, hopefully, that would help him to help her.
Other members of the Allen College community stepped up to offer not only encouragement, but practical help.
Some of my teachers offered me their house to stay in during the summer. The president offered me his house. We convinced my mom that it was okay for me to stay here, that I was going to be okay.
Guillermina didn't tell her son that she was headed for Mexico until she was on the bus that would take her to the border.
Pero ya el autobús la va a llevar directo allá a México?
Sí. Okay. Sí, es directo.
¿Cuándo piensa cruzar la frontera?
Once she was back in Mexico, there was little chance she'd be able to return to the U.S., and Jose knew that if he crossed the border to see her, he might not be able to return. He found himself thinking about his visit home at that winter break.
I was so happy at the moment that I saw her, the moment that I gave her that hug. And I never imagined that was going to be one of the last hugs I was going to give her. I didn't think that was going to be the last time I was going to see her. That hug that she gave me that day, I still carry it with me every day. When I'm going through difficult things, I just remember that.
By last spring, Jose had recovered from his injuries and returned to the track team. He hoped that he'd run well enough to encourage a coach at a four-year college to offer him a scholarship. Jose reached the 2017 regional championships, which Joanna Suarez was anxious to include in the documentary.
On your marks.
In a way, it was a culmination of all the obstacles that Jose had encountered during the school year. I mean, he was so determined. He was running for himself. He was running for his mom. He was running, basically, for all the challenges that he had faced that year.
Jose ran well enough to surprise himself at the championships. His hopes for a scholarship to a four-year school rose.
I do want to keep running, not only because it's my way to college, but it's because, as I said before, it teaches me the disciplines. You know, I get hurt, I get back up. Same thing with my life when it comes to trying to go to college. I find an obstacle, I overcome it.
Jose says he goes to sleep each night thinking about a scholarship, wondering if he'll find a school he can afford.
And the most important thing for schools that will be able to accept me without a Social Security.
In part, the story of Jose Reza is about tenacity, Jose's own tenacity, of course, but also the determination of Tracy Lee, who fed and clothed Jose, and at one point offered to adopt him, if that might help, and the faith of the people who make up the community of Allen Community College. They were certain they could help Jose prevail under the circumstances he and his mother and millions of other undocumented immigrants are facing, circumstances upon which Joanna Suarez hopes to shine some light with her documentary about Jose Reza.
I would hope that anyone who might have any anti-immigrant sentiments would see just how hard our undocumented community works to contribute to this country on a daily basis. Donald Trump got exactly what he wanted. Jose's mom went back to Mexico. But Jose is here to stay, just like so many of our other undocumented students, because they belong. They're here to stay because they belong.
The documentary featured in our story was produced by Joanna Suarez and her team at the TV network Fusion. It's titled Undocumented on Campus. Jose Reza is on track, so to speak, to graduate from Allen Community College in the spring, and he says several coaches from four-year colleges have, in fact, reached out to him about running at their schools. When Bob Berry began coaching a rower who's blind, he wasn't worried.
You don't need to see to row. It's a feel. You don't need vision, except you need to know where you're going.
How Bob solved that problem is coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank CRoss67 for leaving the following review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. Thanks, Bill and team, for all the on-beat and off-beat stories every Saturday morning all these years. I'm glad you find our stories sweet. We are, as always, on the beat. Probably not what he meant. You're welcome, CRoss67, and thanks for helping other listeners find our show by leaving that review. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. Even if it's just in your wildest dreams. Back in March, The Ringer's Claire McNear joined us for this segment. Claire had a theory that Taylor Swift, whom you just heard, is responsible for determining the World Series champion, and maybe you rolled your eyes, but we went back to the archives.
And I think the signs now suggest that she's thrown her weight, such as it is, behind the Astros. Her only show scheduled for the entirety of this year was last month in Houston. Mm. There's an Astros cap hidden in the music video of Bad Blood.
Whoa.
So what I'm saying is, put all your money on Houston.
Claire McNear, welcome back, and I sure hope you took your own advice.
You know what I didn't? I've
oh,
been lamenting
no.
that. I know. It's a disaster, but I hope somebody out there did.
Welcome back also to Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Hi, Will.
Hello. I have a great theory about how Meatloaf has predicted the NBA Finals this year.
I certainly look forward to hearing that on this or perhaps some other week. Will, we're going to start with you.
So, of course, the Houston Astros won the World Series this week. And beforehand, there were eight teams that had never won a World Series ever. The Houston Astros are now off that list. There are only seven teams. You know who you are, other seven teams. I will not embarrass you by saying your names further. However, I will say that I feel as a fan of a team that has won, I don't remember how many, 11 World Series championships, the St. Louis Cardinals. I wrote this piece for Sports on Earth this week to kind of give Astros fans an idea of what the rest of their lives are going to be like. Because no matter what happens, they have this World Series. So I had a few kind of tips for them. One, no matter how tempted you are to do so, because 2017 is now going to be a number you will remember the rest of your life, do not make it your ATM PIN number. Number two, do not buy everything with the Houston logo on it right now. You will want to do this. I have a Cubs fan friend who is a banker who bought Cubs World Series wristbands. I have no idea what he's going to do with his wristbands, what he could possibly do with those wristbands. And the last thing is to remember, and this is kind of a more emotional one, to always remember that this was what it was all worth it. I mean, let's face it, guys. this is a waste of time. Why are we spending all this time caring about sports for this moment? Now, this is hope for those seven other teams. Someday it may be worth it, unless you're the Nationals, of course, in which case it's never going to be worth it. You should stop right now. But congratulations to the Astros and their fans for waiting forever for this moment. It was finally worth it.
You know, I'm on board with almost all of what Will just said, but I've got to say I disagree about the team swag. I think you should stock up on all the 2017 championship swag that you possibly can. For my birthday this year, my boyfriend found an old t-shirt from 1989, which is the year that I was born, commemorating the San Francisco Giants NLCS victory, which didn't turn out too well in the World Series,
oh,
but they
no.
got that far. And you know what? I cherish it. It's full of silly 80s cartoons, and I have made the mistake of not picking up more recent silly t-shirts commemorating more recent wins, but I think Houston fans should go for it.
All right, I'm going to side with you on this, Claire. I agree. Buy everything while it's available, but stop short of having Astros tattooed across your back.
Yeah, tell me that now, Bill. Tell me that now.
It's too late.
I'm not even an Astros fan. This was a terrible mistake.
All right, Claire, it's your turn, and the pressure is on, I guess, to make another bold prediction with or without the help of Taylor Swift.
Well, I don't know if this is a prediction so much as a statement of longstanding reality, but the Browns, they're bad, you might have heard. As is so often the case in Cleveland, the Browns need a new quarterback. They went looking this week ahead of the NFL trade deadline, and they settled on A.J. McCarron, currently with the Bengals. Mm. The two teams settled on a trade minutes before the deadline, but then, as the deadline arrived, word trickled out that the trade, which would reportedly have sent second and third round picks in the 2018 draft to Cincinnati, had fallen apart. Not because either team backed out, but because the Browns somehow managed not to submit confirmation of the trade to the NFL in time. Early reports suggested that they just up and forgot to do it. More recently, we've heard that the Browns sent the Bengals vital paperwork via email with minutes to spare, and the Bengals just simply didn't see it in time. Whatever happened, the whole thing is just so Browns. It seems like nothing ever goes right for this franchise, and now the team's finding new ways for it all to go wrong. So my question for you guys is this just another chapter in the Browns being the Browns, or is this another animal entirely?
Well, for me, the Browns make so many mistakes, spanning organizations, spanning leadership, spanning management. No matter who it is, they're always messing it up. To me, having a trade they wanted to make taken away from them may have, in fact, been the best thing that could possibly happen to the Browns. They did not screw nothing up. I like to think that the NFL actually got all the paperwork in time, looked at it and said, you know, in the same way that you put a dog cone around a dog's collar so they don't bite himself, we're going to go ahead and just refute this one, because it is really amazing when you think about the fact, if you separate the Browns' history from this current Browns team that was rewarded to the city in Cleveland, this is the worst expansion franchise in the history of sports. Bernie Kosar didn't play for this team. This is just a horrible team, and they've been there since they got here. I know Cleveland fans like to think they got their Browns back. I'm still not sure they actually did.
Yeah, they didn't. But for purposes of this discussion, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I'm the oldest member of the panel. And I'm going to remind people that it was in Cleveland for a team called the Browns that Jim Brown played. And that meant something at the time. And by golly, to football fans, it probably still means something. So at least they got that to hold on to. Claire, maybe that's not enough.
Maybe it's not. I'm also partial to this theory. at least not anytime soon. I'm also partial to the theory that maybe the NFL is trying to save them from themselves. But this is a favorite trick of mine when I've got an editor breathing down my neck and I don't want to do any work. I'll say, oh, yeah, I definitely emailed the person I was supposed to email at 4:59 on a Friday.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
All right. I am also focusing on Cleveland. The Cavaliers, last year's NBA runner-up, off to a disappointing start. They've lost to a bunch of teams they should never have lost to. And so we're seeing stories that say the Cleveland Cavaliers are finished. And one story said, it's a shame. LeBron James' last great years are going to be wasted on a team that's no good. I want to suggest that nobody should write off any team that plays 82 games in the regular season after fewer than 10 games. And also, nobody should predict that a team will win a championship 3 years in advance of that championship, unless, of course, the team is the Astros and the predictor is Sports Illustrated. That's my exception. Otherwise, I want strict rules that go into effect limiting people saying this team is finished when they've played about a tenth of their season. You guys are both in the business. Will you go along with my restrictions?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you that it is very silly to make any long-term predictions this early in the season. And you know what? Even the Warriors haven't looked quite like themselves so far. So, I mean, it's early, but you won't find me complaining if we don't get yet another round of Cavs-Warriors in the finals.
Will you have anything left to write about if we institute this limitation?
Yeah, I don't like the idea that all of a sudden things that are bad that are currently happening, someone can just say, oh, well, it's only October, as if that like, okay, well, then these things are all going to be fine. I think the Cavaliers will be fine. Personally speaking, as a Knicks fan, the Knicks are one of the teams that beat the Cavs. I prefer to think the Cavs are, in fact, at their all-time historical peak. It's just that the Knicks are about to win the NBA Finals. That's my only possible takeaway.
I have nothing to say to finish off the thought that the Knicks are going to win the NBA Finals.
You heard it here first.
As a fan of the old DeBuscher, Bradley, Frazier Knicks, I think that would be just fine. It's almost like looking back as far as Jim Brown, isn't it?
I'm going to go comb through a bunch of Taylor Swift videos and see if I can find any evidence that the Knicks are going to win the NBA Finals.
I'll let you go to do that. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Claire McNear and Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you as always.
Rowing as a sport dates back, way back to ancient Egypt, at least. You might think there's not much new in a sport that old. You'd be wrong. Here's only a game's Karen Given.
Ask Bob Barry what it's like to row with Sophia Preeby, and he'll tell a story from the Coast Weeks Regatta in Mystic, Connecticut. This was in 2016.
She and I, we rowed in a pair, which is a sweep oar for each person. And I could only pull whatever pressure she had to keep the boat straight.
Sophia and Bob are not a well-matched pair. Bob's this big, burly guy, and Sophia's barely a teenager.
So when we got to the last 250 meters, I told her, I said, Sophia, this is it. Give it everything till we cross the finish. And I had to give it almost everything I have to keep that boat straight. I couldn't believe it. She rows like she's over 6 feet tall, and she's only, I don't know, maybe 5 feet? We had to settle for third. We missed second place by 11 seconds to this college crew, which is like, that's incredible. This little tiny girl.
That was last year. Sophia is now 14, but she's still only about 5'2". And the thing Bob doesn't mention about Sophia when he tells that story is she's blind. Sophia was born with a rare inherited retinal disease. She's been losing her vision since birth. Some days she can still see colors. Some days she doesn't see anything at all. Bob is Sophia's coach, and when he learned he'd be coaching a rower who's blind, he wasn't worried about it at all.
You don't need to see to row. It's a feel that you can feel in a boat. You can blindfold a complete crew of eight, and they'll all stay together. You don't need vision, except you need to know where you're going.
In the Paralympics, blind rowers are placed in boats with sighted crew members with physical disabilities. They steer the boat. But before we continue with our story, there's one more thing you should know about Sophia.
She's very shy. Yeah, she's not a very talkative person. It's if you get her to talk today, he'll be doing something.
You must be Sophia.
Hi.
I'm Karen. Nice to meet you.
Okay, no sense in trying to build the suspense. I did not get Sophia to talk. When I asked her why she started rowing, she said she didn't know. When I asked her what she liked about rowing, she said she didn't know. Actually, the only question she seemed to be able to answer was whether it was fun to row with her older brother, Dante.
No, he's kind of annoying, I guess. Just yells at me the whole time.
So I did what any reporter with a reluctant interview subject would do. I called someone else.
Okay, so my name is Laura Manfrey, and I am Sophia's mother.
Laura says she signed Sophia up for rowing a couple of years ago. And it was kind of hard to tell. Does she like it?
It's kind of hard to tell anything at this age. She does like the rowing. She is enjoying it. You definitely caught her on a bad day. So in that regard, she is a perfectly normal teenager.
Yeah, a normal teenager, except some doctors say Sophia will lose what remains of her vision by the time she finishes high school. Laura says Sophia's been dancing since she was 3 or 4, but it's become more difficult as the moves get more advanced and Sophia loses more of her sight. That wasn't a problem with rowing. Sophia always rowed as part of a team. Still, rowing on a team wasn't enough for Sophia's coach Bob, because rowers, at least the rowers who aren't blind, can leave the rest of the team on shore if they want to.
I don't want her to feel that there's, well, you can't do that.
Bob knows what it's like to be told you can't do something. He grew up here in Gales Ferry, Connecticut, a village on the western bank of the Thames River.
Named after the Thames that's in London, okay?
But I don't call it the Thames, I call it the Thames.
No, exactly. Yeah.
When Bob was young, there weren't rowing programs for working-class kids in Gales Ferry. Bob would watch the crews from Harvard and Yale practice on the Thames ahead of their annual summer regatta and wish he was on the water with them.
Oh, absolutely. Wanted to go out there, wanted to, you know, go out on a practice with them.
Bob was never far from the sport. Later, he'd be hired to take care of Red Top, the historic Harvard boathouse. Bob was 45 by the time he finally got the chance to try rowing for himself. A few years later, he became a coach. He's determined to share the sport with anyone who wants to give it a try. So, without any sort of prompting, Bob started to research ways for Sophia to row on her own.
He was so excited about this. And, you know, he rows a single himself, so he loves, you know, that freedom of being out on the water on your own, and really wanted her to be able to experience that.
Sophia wasn't exactly enthusiastic about the idea.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that's it. So that could be like, yeah, you know, inside she might be exploding inside with enjoyment, but she doesn't show it.
Bob didn't need much encouragement, but he soon discovered that all the available options seemed to include the one thing Sophia didn't like about rowing, all that yelling.
People have done it by just following them, giving them verbal instructions, keep it even, pressure on port, okay, even it out. So over the winter, I came up with this.
Okay, so you spent the winter on this, so tell me...
I wouldn't say I'd spent the winter. I spent one winter afternoon on it.
Bob called a friend who owns a machine shop. They took apart a couple of smashed-up remote control cars and attached the components to the rudder on Sophia's boat. Bob planned to follow behind Sophia in a launch, using the remote to steer. He called his invention the remote coxswain. Last spring, Sophia Preby went for her first solo row on the Thames River. Bob's girlfriend took a video on her cell phone.
Oh my God, look at that. Give it a turn.
Laura, Sophia's mom, watched.
I wasn't nervous at all. She really is a great rower. And worst case, she swims well, so I wasn't too worried.
A few months later, Bob decided Sophia and the remote coxswain were ready to compete in a regatta. So he talked to the race committee at Coast Weeks. They said, sure, Sophia could row in the singles, but wouldn't she prefer to compete in the class for rowers with disabilities? Bob said no.
I know that she wouldn't want to be in the adaptive event, which is half the distance, 1,000 meters instead of 2,000.
The race committee agreed. They ran Sophia's boat last so that Bob and the remote control could follow behind in a launch.
All right, Sophia, this is it. Woo! Empty that tank.
I gave her the signal. This is the last 250 meters. Empty the tank. Let it go. And she did right to the end.
Oh, my God, Sophia.
Bob says Sophia performed well, and so did his remote coxswain.
Straightest line. Straightest race probably ever rowed on that course ever.
When I asked Sophia if she was proud of how she did in that race, she shrugged her shoulders as if winning or losing didn't matter. But her mom's not buying it.
Yeah, I think she's lying. When the times first came out, it showed that she came 4 out of 6.
And when they said 4th for her, I could see her face. And I'm like, she wasn't happy with that.
Bob had entered Sophia in the class for racing sculls, but she was rowing a much wider and heavier recreational boat.
So she was against boats that are a lot faster.
The race committee took another look at the results. Enough recreational boats had entered the race to warrant their own class. So they made a new announcement. Sophia had won. by a lot.
When she found out she actually went in her class, she seemed pretty happy to me.
There are photos, and I have to say, Sophia looked pretty happy too.
That's only a game's Karen Given. We'll have links to more information about Bob Berry's remote coxswain and Sophia Sees Hope, the organization Laura Manfrey and her husband Chuck Preby founded to support those with rare inherited retinal diseases at onlyagame.org. Former NFL tight end Conrad Ruhlin died last year at the age of 29. Soon afterward, a baseball Hall of Famer received an organ transplant.
And so I called the donor company and I said, I need to know, did my son's heart and left kidney go to Rod Carew?
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, the new politics and history podcast that asks, what is happening? And has it happened before?
Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with decades of experience in Washington. He's a great writer, asks great questions, and always keeps us laughing.
Oh, Heather, stop. Okay, so Heather is not just a noted historian, but she's different. Heather lives in present tense, but also carries history right up with her to this moment.
Every week with our guests, we try and make sense of what's going on. We ask, is this completely unprecedented? Should we panic?
People are freaking out, both Democrats and Republicans. We want you to be able to take a deep breath, then exhale. And by the end of the podcast, you will carry on.
Join us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Freak Out and Carry On.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a salute to some veterans who were also athletes. But right now it's time for my conversation about the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Back in 2014, Sports Illustrated featured a cover story predicting that the Astros would win the World Series this year, and they did, and I hope you saved your copy of that issue.
Oh, of course I didn't, Bill. I recycled it years ago, but apparently, they're going for a grand apiece now, which strikes me as a little bit weird because nobody's going to actually read the story. They're just going to frame the thing and hang it on the wall.
Seven games, a record number of home runs, five of them from World Series MVP George Springer, even the odd terrific pitching performance courtesy of Justin Verlander. What more could a baseball fan ask for in a World Series?
It was terrific. The 13-12 game was just a lot of fun.
What a picnic.
It was Earl Weaver's philosophy come to life, pitching in three-run homers.
Lots you got that of them.
Well, you got half of the philosophy anyway. You got the three-run homers. You didn't get much pitching.
Houston Texans quarterback Deshaun Watson is out for the season now after tearing his ACL during practice. Obviously bad for the Texans, also bad for people who like watching dynamic, creative offense.
Yeah, he was just rounding into incredible form, probably the rookie of the year, and you know, this is one of those very strange non-contact injuries that football players get when they just plant their foot the wrong way. Mm.
An article in ESPN, the magazine, seems to be suggesting that Tom Brady is either a shameless huckster or a deluded fool. This has to do with the diet that Brady endorses. Does he really think that guys who get injured in the NFL are to blame for not taking care of themselves properly?
Well, I think it's hard for me to say this, but I don't know how Tom Brady escaped the clutches of the Scientologists. I really don't. Because this ESPN magazine piece makes him sound either like a cyborg or the biggest sucker who ever came down the track. For example, he sleeps every night in something called bioceramic recovery wear. What does bioceramic mean? Is it like living pottery?
Now you're scaring me.
Seriously. I mean, this is it's a phrase I never heard.
On Thursday, House Republicans unveiled their tax plan, and Golden State Warrior Steph Curry was prominently mentioned. In fact, he was the only person mentioned in the tax. Wait, what?
First of all, it's the zombie tax plan, as we all know, but it says it's designed to help, quote, distinguishing between the individual wage income of Stephen Curry and the pass-through business income of Steve's bike shop. Curry later tweeted, I wonder if Steve's Bike Shop is hiring, which is pretty good, actually.
Maybe you can get a T-shirt at least. Mm-hmm. Steve's Bike Shop T-shirt would be pretty good. According to the college basketball prognosticators working for Associated Press, Duke is the number one men's basketball team this year. You think they got that right?
Oh, they're just lazy. They just put them in there, slot them in there, preseason number one. Hmm. Anyway, they're as good a choice as anyone. They got a good mixture of veterans and young players. Michigan State's number two. That seems to me to be a little bit high. But, you know, again, this is college basketball. This whole thing's going to be turned on its head by January.
Duke always used to have veterans, but it's really something to have a veteran these days, isn't
it? Yeah, well, I was going to say, they've turned into the same kind of assembly line that Kentucky is.
Right. And on the women's side...
Wait a minute. Don't shock me. Don't do this to me, Bill. Let me guess.
Even though they are not the defending champion... It's UConn.
Yeah, of course it is, because they're the best team. And they were the best team last year, even though they didn't get there.
I know that you're a big fan of Alex Ovechkin of the Washington Capitals, Charlie, but how do you feel about his political allegiances?
Yeah, je suis désolé, Bill. I mean, this is a deal-breaker for me. Apparently, he's supporting Vladimir Putin ahead of the next Russian presidential election. Way out on a limb there, Ovi, by the way.
He probably picked a winner.
I think if he picked, like... 75% is the over-under on the vote. I think he'd probably win twice. Yeah, this is too bad. They asked him if he supported Putin's political beliefs. He said, it's not about political stuff.
It's a presidential election.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably honest. It isn't about political stuff. It's about who controls the intelligence apparatus.
Finally, Charlie, if you love to throw axes...
I do.
That's a silly
My goodness, I do.
Who doesn't love to throw axes? Anyway, I got a place that you got to try out in Paris.
Okay, let's go right now.
Tell us a little about Les Cogniers.
Yeah, for 19 euros, which is 22 bucks, for an hour, you can throw an axe at a target on the wall.
Hmm.
I think it's fabulous. I think the sobriety tests prior to throwing the axes are probably recommended.
I think so.
But it would take some of the fun out of it. I mean, all American bars are darts. What's the fun
How much
in darts?
Damage can you
How
do?
How much damage can you do with a dart? Exactly.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
There once was a boy who dreamed, as many kids do, about becoming a pro athlete. And then he met his hero, a Hall of Fame major leaguer, one of the greatest hitters who ever lived. That kind of thing happens all the time. But what happened years after that meeting was a first. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Conrad Ruland had what people in sports call a motor.
I had to put bells on his shoes.
That's Mary Ruland, Conrad's mother.
I needed to know where that little guy was at all times because he just had so much energy. And if I took him grocery shopping, I had to actually harness him in the cart. One time he got out of the cart and I could not find him. And he was hiding in a freezer case. So I had to be on my game with this one, I'll tell you that.
Conrad was on his game, too. By age four, he was pouring his considerable energy into baseball, basketball, soccer, and tennis. When he was 11... he crossed paths with a baseball legend.
He happened to meet Rod Carew at grade school.
Rod Carew, the 1967 Rookie of the Year and All-Star for 18 consecutive seasons. Rod Carew, the 1977 American League MVP and winner of 7 batting titles. When they met, Carew was Conrad's favorite professional athlete in any sport.
And I remember him getting into the car when I went to pick him up, and he says, Mommy, Mom, I met Rod Carew today, and you know he was a pro athlete, and you know I want to be a pro athlete. And the whole rest of the day just resonated with him talking about his meeting Rod Carew, and that sure left an impression on young Conrad.
Conrad played baseball for a time, but focused on basketball and football in high school. He was one of the top tight ends in the country. He played 2 years at Notre Dame and 2 years at Stanford. He was undrafted coming out of college in 2011, but in 2012, he played in 16 regular season games and hauled in 11 passes with the New York Jets. His pro career looked like it was taking off.
It was tremendous.
That's Rolf Ruland, Conrad's dad.
We were so proud of him, and we were so happy for him that he had realized his goals and was now in the big time and playing at the highest level.
But that didn't last long. Conrad suffered a knee injury in 2013, which kept him on injured reserve and practice squads the next 2 seasons. He rehabbed diligently, but NFL teams weren't convinced he could still play. Mary Ruland was.
He was in the best shape of his life. He wasn't done yet.
In the spring of 2016, Conrad was back in California, where he'd often land in between contracts. He had taken business courses and was considering a career in real estate. Conrad was beginning to think about life beyond football. One day, as Mary made dinner, Conrad filled out his driver's license renewal form.
And he says, "Mom, do you think I should be an organ donor?" And I said, "Honey, that's completely your decision." And so he says, "Mom, are you one?" And I said, "Yes, I've always been one." And he says, "You know what? I'm going to do it." I just remember thinking at that time, gosh, I hope it never comes to something like that.
Conrad continued to train at a local gym while waiting for an opportunity with an NFL team. 2 days after Thanksgiving, he called home.
Conrad said that he had had a headache that developed. He had lifted some weights a little bit, nothing real strenuous, and then got on the treadmill. And after a minute or so on the treadmill, he felt like a little click in his head, and he felt the pain behind his left eye. As I'm a physician, I have a little bit of understanding about that. I was just hoping the whole time that wasn't an aneurysm. By the time we got to the hospital, they had already made the diagnosis. It was an aneurysm, and it was a bad one in a bad place. So we knew it was going to be a real tough situation.
Conrad was admitted to UCLA Medical Center. Mary stayed with him. The next day, when she was in the hospital cafeteria getting coffee to ease Conrad's persistent headache, she texted him an encouraging message. He texted back, saying, "I'm about to kick this thing's butt with the help of God. He had something big in store for me." Moments after sending that text, Conrad told a nurse that his headache had suddenly gotten much worse.
And then Conrad's aneurysm burst, and they did the 17-hour surgery to try to save his life.
He'd never again regain consciousness. On December 12, 2016, Conrad Ruland was declared brain dead at the age of 29.
But at least we got the 4 days before it burst to tell him how much we loved him and how proud we were.
As the Ruland's terrible drama played out, a more hopeful one was unfolding. Doctors kept Conrad's body on life support, and the call had gone out to the recipients at the top of the organ transplant list.
We had gone to San Diego for a doctor's appointment.
That's Rod Carew. He had suffered a massive heart attack in 2015. He needed a new heart.
And my wife was driving.
That would be Rhonda Carew.
So on the way back, we received a phone call, and she jumped at it and started to talk to someone, and they'd found me a heart.
I was shaking so badly, and it was like, okay, here it is. This is it. Here we go. And we had a list of people to either text or call, telling them that we were on our way, that we had received the call. And a couple of people texted back and asked the question, "Do you think it's Conrad Ruland?" I didn't know why I was being asked that question.
Rhonda knew the name. The Rulands lived nearby, and the Carews knew Conrad was a pro football player. But she was too worried about her husband's health to give that too much thought. Rod's heart transplant was a success. Actually, his transplants were a success. He got a kidney, too. But he and Rhonda wondered from whom the organs had come. Mary Ruland had wanted to know to whom Conrad's organs had gone. She wanted to meet the recipient. Representatives of the Organ Donation Network told her that the protocol was that they'd have to wait at least a year.
I said, "I don't care. Whoever gets his heart, we would like to meet them." And then the next thing I said was, "And whoever gets his heart better deserve it, because it's a good one."
Conrad's funeral was held on December 23rd, 2016.
Countless people were coming up to me and saying, "Mary, do you think it went to Rod Carew?" And I'm looking at them like they suddenly grew a third eye or something. I'm like, "What are you talking about?" So, you know, the next day I was at home and I started looking on the internet and I saw the whole story of how it unfolded with Rod Carew. And I got to the part where it says the heart of 29.
The heart of 29 is Rod and Rhonda Carew's campaign to raise awareness about heart disease prevention. 29 was Rod's jersey number for his entire major league career. Conrad died at age 29.
I'm like, this is not just a coincidence.
Meanwhile, the Carews discovered that Conrad Ruland had a blood type that was compatible with Rod's.
I mean, it was amazing. It all checked out, and the blood typing was the last item. Now we just need a confirmation that we were right.
Mary got Rhonda's number from a mutual friend, and against the recommendation of the organ donation agency, she called her.
And I think I said something to the effect of, "Hello, this is Mary Ruland, and I think your husband has my son's heart and left kidney."
They talked about blood type and all the amazing factors that helped make the match, but they still wanted confirmation.
And so I called the donor company and I said, "Hey, listen, you know, it's all over the internet, it's everywhere. I said, I need to know, did my son's heart and left kidney go to Rod Carew?" And the lady kind of just paused for what seemed like an eternity, but it was probably just a second or so. And she said, "Yes, it did."
As far as anyone can tell, this was the first time a pro athlete donated a heart to another pro athlete. The families decided to meet in March of 2017. The Carews drove from their nearby home to the Rulands. Rod was nervous, but that didn't last long.
When we pulled up to the house, you know, Mary came out and gave me a big hug and gave Rhonda a big hug. And it was a great feeling for me, because when Mary leaned over to put her head on my chest, I had to hold it back because I thought I was going to cry at that moment. So I held back and waited until she could hear Conrad's heart.
While Conrad had been in a coma after his 17-hour surgery, Mary had spent several days with her ear to his chest, listening to his beating heart. It had been 3 months since she had done that.
I had it memorized. I knew that sound. It was a Ferrari beating in that chest, and that just thrilled me. I was hoping that I would get to hear that heartbeat again.
Oh, boy, and he's beating. So now we're one, we're brothers, and we're going to do great work by spreading the words about donors and getting more people to listen to us, and hopefully they do.
We call ourselves the Carewlands now. You know, we've got a picture of Conrad with our family photos. We spend a lot of time with them. And we only live 12 miles apart, too, which is wonderful. They can listen to Conrad's heart anytime they choose.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach talking with the Carews and the Rulands. We'll have links to the Carews' Heart of 29 campaign and the One Legacy Organ Donation Network at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Jamie Aaron at the American Heart Association. Our intern is Brian Bouchard, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Rod Carew, who got a sudden craving after his heart transplant.
"I never drank coffee. I asked his mom, did Conrad drink a lot of coffee? And she says, yeah, and now I'm drinking 2 or 3 cups of coffee a day."
Huh, I never thought I'd do anything better than Rod Carew, but 2 or 3 cups of coffee, the guy's an amateur. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.